First of all, this is our last meeting, and I want to thank you all for coming. How many of you have been here? I think we met six times. How many of you have been here at least four of those times? Thank you so much. And I know this week I found out is I think there's a whole bunch of things going on. So some people who have been here other months can't be here today, but thank you. I've enjoyed it very much, and I'm very thankful for you to be so faithful to come each month. What I want to do today is actually nothing I'm going to talk about today is new. We have talked over these last 5 months about the seven laws for teachers, how we teach effectively, how we communicate with our students. Sometimes it seems to me just to be able to see an example of a person that models that is a good way to kind of bring it to life. The word incarnate is to put flesh on. And so what I want to try to do this afternoon is simply, most of what I'm going to say is stuff that we've already looked at, but to try to look at how did that look in the person, in the teaching of Jesus, as the one who kind of shows us this is what it looks like to teach this way. So I'm not trying to give you really new things, but to take the laws and the principles that we've been looking at and say, here is how it looked when a teacher, Jesus, taught using those principles. And then I would ask you, as we do that, to say, is that how I teach? Early on, I told you that the thing that I want you to remember is that if I teach well, my students will become like me. If I am a teacher who yells at my students, what are my students going to do if they become a teacher? They are going to yell. A mother. If you're a mother, you are a teacher. If you never receive a paycheck, if you never are called teacher, if you're a mother, you're a teacher. You are in the kitchen, you are busy. You are trying to get supper ready, and someone knocks on the door, rings the doorbell. And you say to your little girl, go tell them that I'm not home. When your little girl becomes 16 and she goes out and she is late getting home from her curfew, and she looks at you and she lies to you and says, well, I was at a friend's house, when in fact she was downtown with a boy. You must never be offended, because who did she learn from? She learned from you how to be a very good liar. When I say to my child, go lie to the person at the door, if I teach them well, they will become like me. And the day will come when they will do what I do. And so as a teacher, I have to ask, if I want my students to be like Jesus, I must ask, do I live like Jesus? Am I the kind of person I want them to be? Because they are going to become like me. Learned from him. When John began to follow Jesus, you remember that John is called the apostle of what?
Love.
The apostle of love. He is famous for his love and his loving attitude. When he became Jesus' disciple, was he at that point, if people knew him, would they have said, ah, there's John. He's a man of love. No. What was his nickname when he became Jesus' disciple? Son of thunder. You don't call a person a son of thunder because of their loving personality. Right? Huh? He grew. He changed. He moved from being the son of thunder to being the apostle of love. How does that happen? Because he became like Jesus. You see, the son of thunder comes to Jesus and says, Jesus, that village that we just passed through, they didn't want to follow you. How about if you call down fire from heaven and blow them up? That'll teach them a lesson, right? And Jesus says, no, that's not what I'm going to do. And John, you know what he thinks right that day? He thinks, Jesus is weak. If I were in charge, this is what would happen. Yeah. And by the way, if you're a teacher, if you're a mother, if you're a father, your students are not always going to catch it the first time. And sometimes they're not going to like what we teach. That's okay. That's okay. But Jesus gives him the lesson. And over time, he sees Jesus' spirit in response to those who hate him. And the day comes when John has been transformed to the point that he is like Jesus. And when people look at him, they say, look at that man of love. The son of thunder is transformed because if I teach well, my students will become like me. Of the disciples, you mean?
Yes.
Because John, I think it's because John had been part of that inner circle. He was the...
Was it because John was at the cross?
I think so.
And nobody else was there, maybe.
That's part of it, but it's also John was uniquely close to Jesus. Closer, it appeared. You know, you have hundreds that he teaches. Out of that hundred, you have 12. Out of that 12, you have 3. And of those 3, John is the one that seems to be the closest. Now, sometimes that really bothers people. They think, why did Jesus have favorites? It used to bother me until I realized something as a teacher. When I teach a class of 40 people, there's going to be some who... Will this be on a test? If I say no, I won't write it down. Okay? They're just there. There will be others who will carefully write everything down. There will be others who will come after class and say, you know, you said such and such. Yeah. I want to know more about that. Well, it's not going to be on the test. Oh, it's not because of the test. I just want to know more about it. Can we talk about it? Of those, which am I going to be closer to? That one. Why? Because they chose to be closer. It's not that I go through the class and say, okay, this is going to be my favorite. No. And I don't think it's at all that Jesus looked at the 12 disciples and said, I like John better than the rest of you. No. But when Jesus was talking, John was there. When class was over and Jesus is walking down the road, it's John who runs up and says, I have a question. Do you care for ask you another question? He is a particularly interested student, and he becomes part of that inner circle. Mm-hmm. Sure.
So sometimes I think maybe for the old, I just guess that the old well probably after he wants to ask too, but they always got the other people. They always put other people. I just
It's possible. There was certainly a lot of rivalry between the disciples. Okay, but in John, we see someone who had a very unique ability to be close. And part of that is personality. Okay? There is nothing I would not... For instance, Thomas was never going to be part of the inner circle. But to me, it doesn't mean there was anything wrong with Thomas. His personality is different. Okay? I can't think of any teacher that I was ever their favorite. Because for me, I am not a person who is close. I'm not going to go to the teacher after class and say, can we go to lunch? I have another question. You know what I'm going to do after class? I'm going to take my notes, and I'm going to go to the library and find a book that will let me read more about what they said. It's a different personality. Thomas was absolutely loyal to Jesus, but he wasn't the kind of personality who was going to come close to him. And the wonderful thing in Jesus' ministry is this, and what I say here is not to say John was better than the others. Okay, the wonderful thing is this, every one of them had a place where Jesus could use them. And so Thomas is going to become a powerful, powerful apostle. Yeah. Right. Who of the disciples does Jesus speak the most, we would say, harsh words to?
Peter,
James, and John. Who are the three inner circle?
Peter, James, and John.
He doesn't say to the other disciples, get behind me, Satan. That's for Peter. He doesn't say to the other disciples, oh no, you're not going to be sitting at my right hand or left hand. That's not for me. But you are going to suffer. That's for James and John. Okay. It's not that they're better. It's simply the interpersonal relationships. But all of the disciples, who spend time with Jesus become more and more like him, except for Judas, who says, I refuse. And we'll come back to that later. They're the rebel. But if I teach well, my students will become like me. So I must ask, do I live like Jesus? And then I have to say, do I teach like Jesus? Because if I want to point them to him, I need to teach like he taught. Because my students are going to become like me, and they're going to copy the way I teach, the way I live. I was teaching in Africa and talking about this. And one of the young men there gave a wonderful quote. And so I stole it from him and added it to my lecture because I was trying to talk about this. And he said this, teaching is first being what I want my students to become. To teach, I must first be what I want my students to become. That's a great way of summarizing what I'm trying to say here. You see, if I want to teach piano and I want to teach students to play with a beautiful sound, what do I have to do? Yeah. You see, let me, is your piano open? If my student is playing, and I say, now you need to play beautifully. And they play, and I say, oh, you didn't play beautifully. Are they going to ever play beautifully? No, because every time I demonstrate, what do I do? It's not beautiful, in case you're not a pianist and don't know. That's not beautiful. Okay? I can't teach students to be a wonderful cellist. Why? I'm not a cellist. Okay? I have to be what I want my students to become. I think I probably told you about going to a workshop up at Hope Sound that someone did. A workshop that was titled, Why Good Teachers Don't Lecture. Now, I think they're wrong. I think good teachers often do lecture. I think lecturing is a good way to teach. But this particular professor believed that you should never lecture. You should use other ways of teaching. That's fine. He did a two-hour lecture on why good teachers don't lecture. At the end, he said, what do you think? And I thought you gave us a great demonstration. And he still doesn't know what I meant. He doesn't know if I meant that it was a great lecture, or did I mean that it was a great demonstration of why teachers don't lecture. He's not sure what I meant. And I'm not going to tell him, so don't you either. But what was he doing? He was trying to teach us to be different than he. Now, if you want to give I think lecturing is perfectly, for me, I'm very comfortable giving lectures, and I learn well from lectures. So I'm happy with that. But if you think that's a bad way to teach, that's fine. If you want to teach your students then, or you want to teach a group of people, let's learn how to teach using group discussion. How do you need to do it? Have a group discussion. Don't lecture to them on why you shouldn't lecture. So I must make sure that if I want my students to be like Jesus, I need to teach like him. Because he is the model teacher. If you go through the Gospels, you will find that the most common title for Jesus is, this is going to be hard, Jesus. Okay, that's the term that's used most often. He's referred to as Jesus 600 times. Makes sense, it was his name. Okay, the second most common is Lord 150 times. Lord. But the third most common, is teacher or rabbi. Okay, two terms for teacher. The third most common name for him in the Gospels is a form of the word teacher. So teaching for him was very important. What I want to do today is to look at the heart of a teacher, the hands of a teacher, and then just briefly, if there's time, the habits of a master teacher. First of all, the heart. The content of his teaching was based on his character. Who he was the foundation for what he taught. And that has to be true for us too. Who we are is the foundation for what we teach. If we are not what we profess to be, can we get by with it? And the answer is yes. But eventually, it will catch up to us. We can get by for a while. We're very good. We can be very good at being a hypocrite. But eventually, it will catch up. And so, what we teach has to be built on the character. So what was the heart of Jesus? What kind of person was he? First of all, he was a person who knew his mission. Turn, if you would, please, to Luke chapter 4. Off of here, I broke it down, but it comes out of that chapter. Jesus reads to them from Isaiah. And then he says to them, today this is fulfilled in your hearing. And in what he read, he gave them a summary of his mission. to proclaim good news to the poor, to proclaim liberty to the captives, to give sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. All of this is his mission. Now, here's why this is so important. If you know the big picture, your mission, that then can control the small daily decisions. If you don't know where you're going, it's very difficult to get there. Right? And yet many people, including teachers, don't really know where they're going. They don't have a sense of mission. They don't know, what am I here for? I have become convinced over the last few years that knowing and writing it down, our mission for life, is incredibly important. And here is the reason, one reason. How many of you can do everything that you have an opportunity to do? You just have unlimited time, unlimited money, and everything that's out there that's available for you, you have the time and money to accomplish. No? How many of you find that sometimes you have to say no to something? A lot. And many times, are you saying no to something that really would be good? Yeah, it's not that you're having to say no to bad things. I'm not talking about saying, no, I don't think I'll become a drug addict. I don't mean that. Okay? I'm saying no to very good things. Every time you say yes to doing something, you're saying no to something else, right? I have come to realize this more and more as I get older because, frankly, a few years ago, I probably thought, even though I knew better, kind of inside me, I thought, oh, I can do everything. You know, there's just don't sleep as much. I used to say as a joke, and it was a horrible joke, well, you can sleep after you're dead. And that, you know, that's kind of what I felt is just say yes, 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 yes. But I am learning that to say yes here means to say no over here. If you're a piano teacher and you can only teach this many hours, then when you say yes to a student, what does that require you to say? No to another student or no to something else. Okay? Now, here's why this is important then. If you don't know your mission in life, what God has called you to do, what God has equipped you to do, how do you know which things to say yes to and which ones to say no to? It's just a guess, right? It's just a reaction, exactly. The reaction of the moment. Now, maybe sometime we need to have a time to talk about how to find your mission. Maybe we need to talk about that. But it is, I am convinced, terribly important for every one of us. Because for every one of us, there are things we can't do. There are things we could do, but we really shouldn't because they're a waste of our time. Then there are things that are uniquely tied to our mission. I began to realize this when I reached a point where I was doing too many things and I was doing them badly. Okay? Because I love to try things. I love to be busy. And I don't enjoy sleeping. To me, you know, it's just not very fun. And so I was go, 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 go. And suddenly I realized, number one, I wasn't doing it well. Number two, I was making everyone around me frustrated because I was always go, 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 go. And you know, they wanted me just to stop and listen. And I began to say to myself, okay, what am I supposed to be doing? What is my mission? And as God helped me to find, for me, not that my mission is better than yours, it's just different. This is what God has called and equipped me to do. And that means now I don't feel guilty sometimes. I used to feel, one reason I became too busy, I felt really guilty to say, no, I won't do that. I have learned, God is helping me to learn to say, no. Why? It's not my mission. It's not something that God has equipped and called me to do. Jesus knew his mission. Now, here is how this mattered in his life. Let me give you an example. Oh, I didn't write it on here. Okay. John chapter 4 gives us an example. Jesus says this. I must needs go through Samaria. Now, if you've been in any classes that I've done here on New Testament or Gospels, you know. Judea, Samaria, Galilee. How did good Jewish people get from Galilee to Judea? Ah, wonderful students. They crossed the river, came down on the east side, and then crossed back over. Because good Jewish people didn't go through Samaria. Because who lived in Samaria? Samaritans. Okay? But Jesus says, I have to go through Samaria. Why? Because his calling is to proclaim good news to the poor, to heal the brokenhearted. And where is that going to happen? In Samaria. There is a woman there who is brokenhearted, who desperately needs help. And that was his mission. Now, let me give you another example, though, because remember, when you say yes to something, what are you doing? Saying no to something else. So listen to this. Luke chapter 12. There were gathered together an innumerable multitude of people, insomuch that they trode one upon another. I was reading that and was shocked. There were so many people that they were walking on each other. It's a mob. And listen to the next words in Luke chapter 12. He began to say to his disciples, first of all. This is a person who knows his mission. Because let me ask you. You walk in on Sunday morning, and this place is so full, that people are walking on each other. They're lined up in the aisles. What are you going to do? You're going to run, okay. Yeah. Wow, look at all these people. You know what Jesus says? He knew his mission. And his mission was first to who? The 12. And so what's he do? He says, you guys, I need to talk to you. Is it because he doesn't care about all those out there? No. But where was his mission? Right here. And he understood that if he trained the 12, what was going to happen for the multitude? They were going to be served, okay? But his mission was training the 12. God really helped me, and I'm telling stories of mine because I'm the only person I know very well. But God really helped me because, you see, I am not a powerful public speaker. And I used to feel horrible. The president of our college, he is a great, he's been down here. President Stetler. He is a great speaker, and you know, he can just move an audience. And I would listen to him, and I would be sitting there listening in chapel, and I would think, I can't speak like that. You know, it's a waste. I can't speak like that at all. And finally, I began to realize something as God helped me to understand my mission. I am not called to lead a crusade. I am not called to evangelize thousands of people. I don't have that gift. I am called to teach people to minister. I have had the opportunity to teach some people who have the gift to evangelize. And my mission then is what? To help them develop that gift. Not to be frustrated by what I don't do. If you can get a hold of what your mission is, it will help you not to be frustrated by the things you can't do. You see, all of us need this. How many of you each day do a to-do list? No? Okay, one. Okay. I'm a list maker. You know, I'm always making lists. This. And my to-do list can get very, very long and I run out of paper. However, I have learned something that is just as important as a to-do list. And that is a to-don't list. Because there are some things that I simply don't need to do. They may be very good things, but I'm not gifted at it. It's not my mission. And I will be frustrated if I try to do it. I was invited to speak for a big convention. One of my students, who liked my classes and enjoyed my class, was on the committee arranging this convention, and so he suggested my name. And I'm proud enough that I thought, wow, you know, they asked me to speak. This is, you know, and there were a few thousand people, you know, wow, I'm really moving up. I was miserable. I don't know if anyone there enjoyed it or not, but I know this. I was miserable the whole time. I hated the preparation. I hated the speaking. I hated the whole thing. Because it's not my mission. And I was looking at 3,000 people, none of whom I knew, so I didn't have any kind of connection with them. They couldn't ask questions. I couldn't answer. I was just speaking. Now, someone like Mr. Stettler, this would be wonderful for him. He would have had them all in tears. I hated it. And I went home and I said, speaking to a convention like this goes on my to-don't list because I'm not good at it. And it's not my mission. If I could become good at it, it still wouldn't matter because it's not my mission. Now, I have a friend who's a very good speaker. And he can speak to that 3,000 people and do a great job. And he would be miserable here this afternoon because you ask a question. And he doesn't like people asking questions. He has a speech to give. And so just shut up and be quiet and let him give his speech. You understand? Okay. So, it is not one is better than the other. It is, what is the mission? Now, that is why I say to you as a teacher, as a person, find what God's mission is for you. Because then you'll be fulfilled. I'll give you one more example and move on. What is Paul's mission? The Gentiles. Yes, and there's more, though. Because think how many Gentiles there are. A whole lot. His mission, he says in Corinthians, is to plant churches, to preach the gospel where it's not been preached before. That's his mission. Okay? To establish. And so what does he do? You can take a map of the ancient Roman world, and you can trace Paul's travels by looking for one thing. Where are the main cities? Why? Because that was his mission. And so where does he go? He goes to Ephesus. Now, Ephesus is not the place to go. It is a pagan city dedicated to the worship of Diana. It has a great temple. You're not going to be successful in Ephesus. But why does Paul go there? That's his mission. And he marches in there, and what's he do? He plants a church right in the shadow of the temple of Diana. Now, let me show you what he does, though. He doesn't go to Colossae. He doesn't go to Colossae. That's a little village a few miles from Ephesus. And Paul never goes there. Why? What's his mission? To plant churches where they've not been planted in the central areas to reach everywhere else. And Colossae, instead of being Miami, Colossae is Stuart, Florida. It's a perfectly good place. But if you reach Miami, you reach all of South Florida. If you reach Stuart, you reach Stuart. Right? Now, is one better than the other? No. But here's my point. Paul's mission is Miami. And so he goes to Ephesus and he plants a church there. We have a letter to the church at Colossae, right? But Paul never went there. Instead, someone who was converted in Ephesus went to Colossae. They were from Colossae. And why had Paul been so committed to Ephesus? Because he knew everyone comes to Ephesus. If I can plant a church here, I'll reach Colossae. I'll reach Stuart. And so they come. They go back. And who is the father of the church in Colossae? Paul. But he's never been there. But he's the one who plants the church that wins the person who goes to Colossae. You see? See what I'm saying? His mission is governed. His daily decisions are governed by his mission. And if you can find what is God's mission for me, it helps you so much. Now, part of the struggle is this. We all like someone else's mission. Right? How many of you can immediately think of someone else that you wish you were like? That God had given you their calling and their gifts? Yeah. I already told you. I've told Mr. Stetler this. I've said, you know, every time you preach, I struggle with jealousy. I think, oh man, I wish I could speak like that. I want his mission. No, it doesn't work that way. Okay? But if you can find what is God's mission for you, that determines then on a day-by-day basis. Paul knows this is my mission. This is what God has for me. And so every time he goes to a Corinth, it means he doesn't go somewhere else. But it's okay. It's his mission. Jesus goes to Samaria. Why? It's his mission. But then there is something very special in John chapter 4. He talks to the woman at the well. She brings others there. They're listening. They love what they're hearing. And it says he left. I read that and it doesn't make sense. I mean, you're preaching, you're helping these people and they love it. Don't you want to stay and spend more time there? Why does he leave? Because his mission is to go on. This was part of his mission, but he's done it. And now it's time to continue. Because if he stays in Samaria, he will never accomplish the mission that he had to reach first the Jews, and then the Gentiles, the Samaritans, and the Gentiles. You understand? So your mission determines what do you do? What do you not do? So many times, I think we live our life in the instant. What do I do? What do I do? What do I do? Rather than understanding first, what is God's calling and mission for me? And then measuring everything else under that. That guides us in our daily decisions. Jesus knew his mission. Now, let's move on. Jesus knew the needs of his students. Again, this is nothing new. Yes. Yeah, we probably need some time to do a session on how to find your mission. No, that's fine, because it sounds like we could spend a day here, couldn't we? I will say this just on the surface. Number one, your mission doesn't always line up immediately with your natural abilities entirely. And part of that is because I think God really loves to make sure that he gets the glory for what happens, okay? And if it's all my abilities, who gets the glory? Yeah, me, right? And so sometimes I think God puts us in a place where we know if this works, it's him. It's not me. Okay, so that's part of it. The other thing I would say, and I say this very cautiously, and I say this knowing that I really wish we had a couple hours to examine it more. But while you may not enjoy every aspect of your what you do for your mission, I really think that your mission as a whole will bring joy. And if it doesn't, you have to start to ask, am I missing something in understanding my mission? Let me give you an example of what I mean with that. I really feel that God's calling in my life and my mission is training people for ministry. And one of the biggest aspects of that for me is training people who don't have access to come here and get training in an American college, going overseas and doing it. Okay. I really feel that God's call, if I had the resources of finances and time, I would spend all of my life traveling overseas training pastors and teachers there. That's really where I feel the most passion for my ministry. But I absolutely hate to travel. Flying to me is misery. From the time I leave to go to the airport till I get back, flying is miserable. I just came back yesterday. Sue and I, it was our 30th anniversary. And usually for our anniversary, we go to Sweet Tomatoes. But, you know, after, and even get a drink, you know, we go all out, get, you know, not just the salad bar. We actually buy iced tea. But for our 30th anniversary, I said, you know, let's do something really special. And so we wanted to go to Alaska. And so I was able to get frequent flyer miles and find a cruise that was on sale, and we went. And it was wonderful. However, we're flying back. Delays. Ended up all night at the flying and a whole day at the airport. We get back and I said, I'm never, ever going on vacation again. It's not worth it if you have to travel to get there. So I say that to say the flying, I don't enjoy. I'm not good with new foods. I have a very plain kind of appetite. However, the mission as a whole, when I come back from teaching or when I'm in Nigeria teaching, I am happier, more fulfilled than anything I do. Okay. So will there be aspects of your mission that make you miserable? Very likely there will be. Okay. Very few of us does God say, my mission for you is to live in luxury and have everything flawless and perfect in your life. I don't know why, you know. He just almost never does that. I volunteered one day. I said, you know, God, if you want to put me in a nicer house to, you know, teach me the discipline, I'm willing. He doesn't do that. So will there be aspects of your mission that are uncomfortable? Yes. Will there be aspects of your mission that you say, I don't enjoy this, I'm not good at it? Yes. But I'm really convinced that if you find your mission, it is going to bring you joy. I'll tell you one other story from our trip. I took a picture. I'm going to put it into a PowerPoint sometime for a lecture for my students. Took two pictures of people. The first picture is a picture of a group of ladies that were on this cruise, and they sat at the table next to us. I watched them for 7 days. 7 days of misery. Every meal was bad. They didn't like each other. They argued with each other. I enjoyed just watching. Just wow. Yeah. They were much more entertaining than the people paid to entertain. 7 days of misery. Now, there was a waiter there. He was from the Philippines. I took a picture with him. I just love this guy. His job was to come around with a cart and say, would you like coffee or juice? Coffee or juice? Coffee. But this man loved what he was doing. Come through in the morning. Happy coffee, happy coffee. Anybody need happy coffee? happy juice. Anyone want happy juice? I would get something even when I didn't really want any, just so he would come to the table. And I would say, Raphael, how are you this morning? I am great. What are you going to do today? I'm going to give happy juice to everyone. The last day of the cruise. He comes around and he says, farewell coffee. I want to give you coffee to say farewell, farewell, farewell. And here are these four ladies. He makes too much noise. Why is he coming around every day? So I took their picture. And I took his picture. And I'm going to put them side by side to remind me. Because here's what was to me amazing. Those four women paid a bunch of money to travel and be miserable. He has a job that really is kind of at the bottom of the totem pole on the boat. I mean, he's not driving the boat. He's just pouring coffee. He was happy. He was fulfilled. Okay. Your mission isn't going to all be about happiness, but I am convinced that if you find your mission, you will be fulfilled doing it. Okay? Now, he knew his mission. He knew the needs of his students. This is a review of things we've talked about. But many, many times in our teaching, we focus almost entirely on the lesson. Yeah. Right here. Okay? I'll be honest. I'm looking at the clock and I'm thinking, I know that I have 10 things that I want to get through, and we're on number 2. But you know what? Jesus doesn't do that. Instead, he focuses on the students, on their needs. He doesn't always give them what they want, but he does give them what they need. He came to the poor, the brokenhearted, the captives, the blind, the bruised, the hurting. And he knows what they need. What does the Samaritan woman want? Water. She came for water, right? But he knows she needs redemption and meaning. So he gives her that. Peter is out fishing. What does he want? Fish. He would have been thrilled if Jesus had said, I'll give you 100 fish. Right? But Jesus knew that what Peter needed was not more fish. Peter needed a mission in life. And so he says, Forget the fish. I'm going to make you a fisher of men. Listening to Jesus teach, and they want bread. He gives them bread. But then he talks to them about the bread of life. And John 6, verse 66 says, when he finishes, many of them went away and did not follow him anymore. Why? Because he was giving them what they needed, not what they want. And most of us, quite honestly, don't like it when someone gives us what we need instead of what we want. Right? We want someone to tickle our ears, to make us feel good, to build us up. That's not always what we want. Jesus looked at what they needed. Zacchaeus has the self-esteem of an earthworm. He just feels worthless. What does he need? He needs someone to say one word to him. Zacchaeus. Because if someone knows his name, that's incredible. I'm really bad with names. I'm sorry. I am terrible. And most of you, I just have to hope you don't wonder if I know your name, because usually I don't know names. But while I was principal, there was a boy in kindergarten. And when I was principal, I wasn't good with names. But I would get there early in the morning, and I would go through the yearbook reading the names and pictures to try to learn them. It didn't work. I still couldn't remember their names. But Michael stood out because in kindergarten, kindergartners are this tall. Michael was this tall. Okay. He was big. He was clumsy. From a terrible home situation. The last day of school, he was still wearing the uniform he wore the first day. You know, just a very difficult thing. But I would try to see the kids, and as I could remember their names, I would say their names. So I'm walking down the sidewalk one day. This is in kindergarten. He's in kindergarten. And here comes the kindergarten class. And hi, hi, hi. You know, I'm talking to them. And I say, how are you, Michael? And hi, hi, hi. The teacher comes to me after school. And she said, Michael came up to me and said, why does that man know my name? And the teacher said, he knows everyone's name here. He's the principal. She was lying, but she didn't know she was lying. I didn't know everyone's name. Michael said, no, no, no. He didn't say everyone's name. He said, my name. He said, how are you, Michael? Every day that year, I tried to see Michael sometime during the day and call his name. He'd say, how are things, Michael? And at first, he would run to the teacher. Why does that man know my... But he started, I'm fine. He's in 10th grade now. Not the principal anymore. He's now this big. He plans to be a preacher. God has worked in his life wonderfully. But in April, I had been gone, and I'm not around the academy anymore, you know, so I don't see them. But he will see me on campus, and I had been gone. And he came to my wife, and he said, where is Dr. McElwain? I always try to see him, and he's gone. Where is he? Michael needed what? His name. He needed someone to know who he was. And that little thing, and again, I get no credit because it's a miracle that I know Michael's name. I call my own children by the wrong name sometimes. Pardon?
Your name is Michael too.
No, my name's not Michael. No. But you understand that God, and here is why to me it is a wonderful privilege for you to be a teacher. God knows the needs of your students better than we do. And He can work through you to do what we would never. I would never know that, you know, I need to call Michael by his name. I wouldn't even know his name. It's a miracle I didn't say, how are you, Mr. Whatever your name is. Okay. But God knew what He needed. And God uses us to do it. Know the needs of your students. You see, the students that are the most frustrating to you are the ones that need the most. Proverbs 25. If your enemy is hungry, give him bread to eat. Now, we say, if your enemy is hungry, say, ha ha ha, they're getting what they deserve. Right? Proverbs is not about primarily, I need more time to explain this, so don't quote me on this. But Proverbs is not primarily about, quote, spiritual advice. It's about practical advice. And I need to explain that, but I don't have time right now. But it's a very practical book. And he is saying this, if you've got an enemy, what should you do? Give them what they need. And what's that going to do on a very practical sense? It will cause a fire on their head. And you know why in the old world, why they put fire on your head? It was cold. And so you had these caps and you put coals in them. And it kept your head warm. And if your head is warm, your body stays warm. It's not, Proverbs is not saying, which we would like for it to say, do something nice and you're going to really make them miserable. It's saying, do something nice and you're going to meet their need. And you know what? It's really hard to stay the enemy of a person who cares about meeting your needs. Isn't it? I mean, that's kind of tough. If they genuinely are trying to meet your needs, it's hard to stay their enemy. Proverbs is saying when you have an enemy, find what they need and meet their needs. In your class, you probably have some student that you pray for every day. And you pray something like this, Lord, help them to move to North Dakota. Because they cause you trouble, they don't listen, they delight in causing trouble. That student probably has greater needs than anyone else in your class. There's a reason they're such a problem. And if somehow you can find out what is it they need, and begin to meet that need. Again, I'm not good at this. I'm going to give you one example where God helped me to do it right. I won't tell you about the 112 times I didn't do it right. But Joel was in my college freshman Bible class, and he was the student that I prayed for every day. God, send him home. Don't let him be here. Because Joel constantly was trying to find something I was wrong about to try to publicly, you know, correct me. No, I don't think that verse says that. Or yes. There's a commentary and it says that verse means something different than what you said it means. I took Greek when I was in high school, and in Greek it means, and I read, Joel, can I get by with strangling him? And God began to help me to realize something. Joel is very, very intelligent. And he desperately needed for people to know it. Later, I met his family and realized he is incredibly intelligent, but in his family, his mother was a lawyer, his father was a medical doctor, and in his family, he was kind of dumb. Okay? Yeah, And I started, God help me. It wasn't, I usually miss this. But I would come to class and I would say, Joel, I want to look at such and such a verse next class period. Do you mind to look that up and just give us 2 minutes at the start of class about what that verse means? Because you can explain it and then I'll talk about what you do. Joel became... Pardon? Yeah. My ally. We were no longer enemies. He no longer had to show his intelligence by trying to find me wrong in something. Now, he was on my side. And genuinely, I could truthfully say, often he would say something in the class that I would not have thought of, because he truly was a brilliant, brilliant student. If I did not find that need, the entire class, he and I, would have been at war. Because the only way he could meet his need was by being smarter than me. And since I'm the teacher, I need to be smarter than him. Right? And you see where this is going to go? Neither of us are going to finish that semester very happy. Okay? The happiest day for me is going to be the day after he's gone. But as it turned out, at the end of that class, I miss him. Why? Because I was able, God showed me his need, and I was able to start to meet it. And believe it or not, at the end of the class, he misses me. Because I was meeting a need that he had. Find the needs of your students. Over and over, Jesus finds the needs of his students. He understood them. Luke 6 tells us that he knew their thoughts. Mark 10, Jesus looks at this rich young ruler who comes to him. Everyone else who saw the rich young ruler saw a spoiled rich kid. But listen to what Mark says. Then Jesus beholding, and that word is a word that means to discern and to understand him. Then Jesus, understanding him, loved him. I can almost guarantee you that the student in your class who is the most frustrating to you, if you can really understand them, you will love them. We get frustrated when we don't understand them. They're different than we are. And so we begin to react. I tell this with a little bit of fear because I don't want you to quote me to my children. But of my children, one of them thinks very much like I do. The other one does not. Do not quote me because I don't want them to, know that I said this. And I'm not going to tell you which is which. But I'll tell you this. The one that doesn't think like me, I've laid awake at night a whole lot longer. Why? Because how in the world did they do that? What were they thinking? Why? I don't understand them as well. Now, when I can finally understand why they do what they do, I may still think it's wrong, but at least I understand. Here is why it happened. For our students, this is why a couple months ago I said to you, yes, you have to know your subject, but you also have to know your students. What is it that interests them? What is their world like? This is hard for me because I think I was born about 100 years too late. I would be very happy in about the 19th century, that technology was far enough along. My students send me these text messages. And I say, don't send me text messages. I hate texting. And now they have these, what do you call them? Emoticons. Emojis. And I look at this thing.
You can't figure
what
out.
What is this?
David's smiling.
And so I hand it to my wife because I don't know what's wrong with her. But she likes these. And I say, here, answer it. Tell me what they, you know, tell them whatever. I don't even know if they're saying I'm happy or I'm sad or I'm laughing at you or I think you're a moron. And I say, you know, is there an emoji that says, this is stupid, that I can send back to them? But you know what I'm figuring out? I have to take the time to understand that. Because if I say to my students, you know, the way you communicate is just dumb, that probably is not going to allow me to meet their needs. Okay? So instead I have to say, I understand your emojis, and they're dumb. I can say that after I understand it. But you understand, we have to understand our students. I can't teach them if I don't understand them. And so when Jesus heals a leper, how's he do it? He touches them. To me, that's amazing. Number one, it's amazing to me because I'm not a toucher and I don't like to touch people. And I for sure don't like to touch people who are sick. Daniel said to me that Joshua had a fever today. And he said, so you'll only see him once. And inside I thought, no, I won't see him at all. He has a fever. I don't want to talk to him. I don't want to see him. I'm not going to shake his hand. Hi, Joshua. You stay over there. I'll stay over here. Everything will be great. And if I find out he has leprosy, I'll send him an email. But I'm not going to show up at the room. But you see, a leper was required, when anyone came near them, to say what?
Unclean.
Stay away. Don't come close to me. What do they need? Yes, they need healed. But you know what they really need? Is someone to touch them. Jesus knew that what they needed was a touch. He understood something beyond the surface. Tax collectors, Zacchaeus. What Zacchaeus needed was someone to know his name, someone to value him. And so Jesus says, Zacchaeus, get down. Go prepare lunch for me. I'm hungry. Nobody had ever said to Zacchaeus, I want to come to your house to eat. Jesus knew what he needed. Simon Peter, one of my favorite verses in the Bible, in Mark, the angel says to Peter at the tomb, now remember, Peter has denied Jesus. He feels his life is ruined. Even the news of the resurrection. Yes, it's going to be good news, but it's also going to be, Jesus won't want to talk to me. I denied him. And so at the tomb, the angel says, go tell his disciples. Oh, thank you. Go tell his disciples and Peter that he will meet them in Galilee. Why? Because Jesus knew that what Peter needed more than anything right then was to know that he was invited. I encourage you for your student, sit down and begin to ask, what is it that they need? The troubled ones, what is it that I need to understand about them? And to say, God, I don't understand this one. This one is just too much for me. Something is wrong. But James says, if we lack wisdom, what do? We ask, and God will give it. And I would encourage you with your students, the ones that you struggle with, ask God to give you wisdom to understand them. Let me give you another example from Paul. 1 Timothy 5, a little scripture that to me, I always, when I read this, think, why is that in there? Paul's writing to Timothy, and he says, no longer drink only water, but use a little wine for the sake of your stomach and your frequent ailments. I think, why does that need to be in the Bible? But you see, Timothy, from everything we read about him, appears to be very conscientious and very nervous. He's afraid he's going to do it wrong. He's young and he's replacing Paul. Now, Mrs. Shee is here. But Pastor Shee, imagine that the church, a 22-year-old pastor comes in after Pastor Shee retires. And you older people are looking at this kid. Yeah, he's going to tell us something. That's how Timothy felt. Everyone in the church there is thinking, and he thinks he can replace Paul? Oh, no way. Timothy's getting an ulcer. Literally, that's what the letter is saying. He's getting an ulcer. He's constantly upset. And Paul understands him. And he says, you know, in this letter, of all the big things, I'm going to take time to just let him know that, you know what, Timothy? This is what you need to do for your stomach. Demas. Paul says, Demas has left. Why? He loved this present world. Now, let me ask you a question. Don't raise your hand. Yeah, you can raise your hand on this one. How many of you have ever had a student who quit coming to your class? Okay, only one. Most of you, wow, that's amazing. Okay, I have to raise both hands. Now, here's the question maybe you shouldn't answer out loud. Did you find out why they left? You see, as a teacher, it's easy for me to say, well, they left, okay, you know. If they don't want to learn, that's too bad. Paul actually cared enough about Timothy. He understood him enough. I'm sorry, Demas. To find out, why did he leave? He loved this world. That's a very sad reason. But it impresses me that Paul actually found out. He understood his students. He cared enough about them to know. You see, one of the challenges for teaching is this. The longer we're away from a kind of person, the harder it is to think like them. The further we are removed from a person, the harder it is to think like them. In other words, do we have any engineers in here? Okay, all right. So you've been to graduate school. You understand engineering, right? Which is going to be easier for you? To explain an engineering problem to one of your peers or to explain a math concept that is essential to engineering to a first grader? Yeah, because you're right there. It's been a long time since you had to figure out 2 + 3 is. And when they say, why is it 5? Because. But why do they call it 5? At that point, you say, I want to go talk to an engineer. You understand? I'll give you an example. I was teaching in South Africa and was staying at the home of a man, an Afrikaans man, who works for the government. And his job in the reorganization of South African society and doing away with apartheid, the blacks who had worked on the farms of the Afrikaans people now were given farms to manage. And they didn't know what to do with it. And these farms were disasters. because they had been used to doing one job. And that's all they do is whatever their master tells them to do, they do it. Now they have the whole responsibility. And they weren't growing any crops, weren't doing anything. And so the government set up a program where they brought in people to teach these black farmers to farm. And this man was one of the teachers. And I said to him one day, he was telling me about his job, and we were talking, and I said, what's the hardest thing? What's the hardest part of doing this training? And he said this. The hardest thing is teaching people to do something that I have always known how to do. You see, he said, I grew up on a farm doing all of the jobs. And then my dad turned the farm over to me, and I did all the jobs. I never had to learn how to do this or this or this or this. And he said, what is very hard for me is to think through, if I didn't already know how to do this, how would I do it? Does that make sense? As a piano teacher, it is not difficult for me to know how to teach a person who comes to me and they've played the Grieg piano concerto. Joshua, the Grieg piano concerto, and they play it and I can say, you need to do this better and you need to do this better. That's not hard. It is, for me, often a challenge for some little, cute little five-year-old, and I'm trying to teach them where to put their fingers on middle C, and they want to know, why is it called C? That's its name. You understand? The further we are. Now, you think about your students. You do upper elementary. It's been a long time. Don't be offended. But it's been a long time since you were in upper elementary. At least 10 years. Okay. We often are teaching people, it's been a long time since that was new to us. And it can be difficult for us to understand through their eyes. And so what we end up doing is saying, go read a book. Or, you know, how can they be this dumb? Why don't they understand this? If we teach like Jesus, what do? We keep studying our students, learning to think like them, learning how do they think, how can I help them. Sometimes, one of the best things, just a practical thing, is ask some of the students. You teach it. You have a student who knows how to do it, you show the others, because they will approach it differently. Because they just learned it yesterday. Learning how our students think. Now, let's move on. I'm going to... The master teacher was patient. We're still talking about the heart of a teacher. Mark shows us this. Jesus says to his disciples, why are you so fearful? How is it that you have no faith? Chapter 6, they did not consider the miracle of the loaves, for their heart was hardened. And then one of the most amazing ones, chapter 8, he just got through feeding 5,000. And there's 4,000 people here, plus women and children. And the disciples say, what are we going to do? How are we going to feed them? Look how many there are. And if I'm the one in charge, I'm going to say, how is it that you are so dumb? Is it math that's a problem to you? Because 4,000 is less than 5,000. Are you not good at math? But what's Jesus do? He teaches the lesson again and again and again. As teachers, this is something you must never say, and I've said it. I've already taught them that. They know it. If they don't know it, I haven't already taught it. I may have said the words. I may have gone through the lesson, but I haven't taught it yet if they don't know it. But so many times, and again, this is why I keep saying to you, we've got to teach students, not curriculum. Because what do? We have a book. Week one, week two, week three, week four. And the students are still trying to understand lesson one, and we're on lesson four, five, whatever. Which would be better, if we get through all of the lessons and they don't understand them, or if we only got through lesson one, but they really did understand lesson one? Wouldn't that be better? At least that way the next quarter someone could teach them lesson two. But as it is, we just keep on marching along and they don't get a foundation. Susanna Wesley taught all of her children. She had 19 children. Now, before you put her on too high of a pedestal, I think 10 of them died in infancy. And most of the others were sent off to boarding school when they were about 10. So she didn't have 19 children at home. Sometimes she's kind of, you know, put on a pedestal. But she would teach them, and she would go over and over and over. Her husband, Samuel, was never known for patience. He was a rather difficult man to live with or to be around. And he was listening one day, and he said to her, "I watched you teach that child the same thing 20 times today." And this is what she said: "If I had only taught it 19, it would have been a waste, because it was 20 that he finally understood it." Patience. Think about Paul at Corinth. I tell my students, ministerial majors, pray that you never are sent to Pastor Corinth, the world's worst church ever. They have every problem there is. And Paul writes them. And by the way, 1 Corinthians is not his first letter to them. It's the second. So understand something. This sounds confusing, but I want you to see something. He writes them first a letter. It doesn't work. He writes what we call 1 Corinthians. It's his second letter. They get mad. He writes them a third letter that is lost. It's called the painful letter. In other words, it was so harsh that he says it caused pain for me to write it and pain for you to get it. Someone throws it away because we don't have it. He writes a fourth letter, trying to somehow get them to listen to him. Here's what I want you to see. Over and over and over. And it's the same thing. I'm sorry, but after that first letter, there would be no 1 and 2 Corinthians. Because after that first letter, I would say, forget you. You don't want to listen. You don't want to do what I tell you. Just go on and forget about it. I'm going back to Ephesus. But Paul is patient. He understands the people. He loves the people. And he keeps teaching over and over and over. For your students, don't just go through the lesson. Understand them. And then have the patience to do it until they get it. A test of your patience is this: how many times are you willing to teach a lesson before you give up? Because you see, if the student is important, and if the lesson is important, then it's worth doing over and over until you get it. right? Now, if what I'm teaching isn't that important and they don't get it, that's fine. I'll just move on. Or if the students aren't important, okay, fine. I'll just move on. But if I'm teaching God's Word, and this is of eternal importance, and I'm teaching students who will live eternally, do you understand it's worth doing it again? It's worth putting forth the effort and the patience to go on and on. I have such admiration. I was talking to actually President Stetler the other day about this. I have such admiration for pastors and leaders who stay at one place on and on. The average, I think, nationwide, the average pastor has been there 1.7 years. And you know why? Don't anyone get offended, but some of you are probably hard to get along with. You know, I don't know who you are, but some of you probably are hard to get along with. I can't imagine. And pastors over and over simply say, you know what? The first year is your honeymoon, they call it. That one's pretty easy. I'm going to go have another honeymoon and another honeymoon. And I have great admiration for a pastor who stays and just keeps plugging away. Because you know what? That's what has the long-term impact. When we stay at a job and we keep doing it until we understand the people and we are patient to keep teaching and teaching and teaching. Jesus was patient. I'm going to move on. I think I've said enough that you understand that Jesus loved his students. But over and over, the Gospels show us a teacher who loved his students. Again, back to your trouble student. The troublemaker in your class is someone who there's no one in their life that really loves them. Brandon was in our school and he was a constant troublemaker, constant troublemaker. Every teacher would bring him into my office. We would talk. And one day I happened to be with his, where his family was. And suddenly I understood something. You see, the only time anyone in his family ever paid any attention to Brandon was when he did something wrong. As long as he was the youngest in the family, it was a big family, and they were all busy, and as long as he was good, no one even knew he was around. But as soon as he did something wrong, Brandon, you stop that. And what did Brandon hear? Brandon, exactly. Brandon's kind of like my dog, my wife's dog. You know, you can say, Emmy, don't ever do that again. You're a very bad dog. You know what Emmy hears? Emmy, 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 right? Brandon needed someone to love him. And one year he was very blessed. In elementary, he got a teacher who truly, truly loved and understood him. Brandon never had to come to my office that year. Now, this isn't always true. But he felt that teacher's love. She cared about him. And to this day, that's been 7 years, to this day, Brandon points back to that teacher as the one who absolutely changed his life. Love your students. Now, let me give you this because I think it's a very helpful, practical thing. I know we're almost out of time. But when you're looking at your lessons, I found this the other day, and it seems to me to be a good way to ask, am I focusing on what I am doing, or am I focusing on my students? And what I've been trying to say to you all day is we've got to make sure that we're understanding our students, that we're focused on our students, not on our lesson. So when I look at my lesson, which is it? Am I focused primarily on the activities or on the results? You understand? If I'm focusing just on my lesson, I'm going to say, okay, I want them to to do this. We're going to color a page. We're going to do an Hannon exercises 5 times. We're going to cut out something, activity. If I'm focused on the students, I'm going to ask, what's the results? One of the things that sometimes will really frustrate a student, I don't do this with young ones, but with a college one. They'll say, how much do I need to practice? And I'll say, I don't care. How good do you want to be? Huh? If you want to be really good, you're going to have to practice a lot. If you don't want to be very good, you don't need to practice very much. They're going to pay me the same regardless, so it's entirely up to you. And some of them will come back after a week, and I'll say, how much do you practice? Not very much. No problem. Really? No. Not going to be very good. That's no problem to me. There's lots of bad pianists in the world. You'll be one more. It's okay. I won't do that with most students. But the ones that I will do that with are the ones that I can see. They really want to be good, but they don't have discipline. And if I yell at them, they'll do it, but they won't get the discipline themselves. But usually with those kids, after about 3 or 4 weeks, they'll walk in, they'll say, I'm not going to learn anything this year, am I? Don't think so. Because I'm not practicing enough, yeah? So what do I need to do? And at that point, we move from what I'm telling them, mark on your paper 55 minutes a day, to how good do I want to be? Focus on the results with your students. Teacher-centered teachers say, how well did I teach it? Did I get through all my lessons? Check. Did I tell a good story? Check. Did I keep them all sitting in their seats without running around and crawling under the pews? Check. But if I'm focused on my students, I ask, did my students leave understanding something that they didn't understand when they came in? Did I give them a better understanding of what I'm teaching? Teacher-centered teaching focuses on today's lesson. Student-centered teaching focuses on what is the long-term result. What is it that my students are going to be different because of what we did today? Because, again, back to the very first slide, if I teach well, my students will become like me. And so as a teacher, I must be saying, what is the long-term goal? Where am I wanting to take my students? Now, all of that is on the heart of the teacher. Let's look for about 10 minutes at the hands of the teacher. The methods. How did Jesus teach? The first thing I've said here is he taught with authority. Mark 1, they were astonished at his teaching. He taught them as one who had authority, not as the scribes. I said to you a couple months ago, you must know your students, but you must also know your subject. It has become very popular among teachers, this saying. Students don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. I understand the saying, but I don't like it very much. Because if you're teaching math, you really need to know math. I have a friend, I won't say their name. She's a good lady. She really is a very good lady. She teaches piano. You don't know her. I have listened to her students play now for 20 years, and I have never heard one of her students play a piece well. Never once. They play badly. They don't learn their pieces. And I'm not talking about on occasion. I'm just saying consistently. I've never heard. And one day I was talking to her husband, and he was telling me how much his wife loves teaching. And he said, now, she doesn't have the philosophy that you teachers at the college have. And I said, oh, really? What's that? She said, well, you teachers at the college, obviously we were doing it wrong. You're focused on teaching them how to play the piano. But her focus is on just loving them and getting them to care about their heart and their spiritual needs. And I said, well, that's very nice, but didn't they sign up to learn to play the piano? Well, yes, but that's not really what she's interested in. She's interested in their spiritual needs. I said, do you think it's possible that if someone signs up to learn to play the piano, that they want you to teach them to play the piano? Well, what about their spiritual needs? I said, I think maybe they would learn something spiritually if they learned to play the piano from their piano teacher. Now, here's my point. I've already said, I hope you understand that from what I've already said. Should you love your students? Yes. Should you care about them? Yes. Should you care about their spiritual needs? Yes. But Jesus knew his subject. He taught with authority. You teachers who are teaching Sunday school class, don't you ever, please, never ever say, well, it's just a Sunday school class. I can fake it if I need to. One of the most embarrassing things in my life, I was playing at a church, and I still play at a church, and I try to work at it. I try to practice. I try to come in with my music ready and prepared. But I'd had a very busy week, and normally I would have been practicing. I went on a trip, and I came in on Sunday morning, and I had not prepared anything. And I thought, you know what, it's okay, because I think I play well enough that they won't really notice. So I'll just go and I'll open the book, and, you know, that's not a good thing, but it'll be okay. So I went and I played. At the end of service, here comes this lady, and she says, I want you to meet my son. He's visiting me. And I said, oh, hi. She said, my son plays the trumpet in the New York Philharmonic. Now, for those of you who are not musicians, the proper response is, oh dear. Because the New York Philharmonic is one of the top three or four orchestras in the country. I began to apologize. I said, I was out of town this week and I haven't practiced, and normally the music is better. Our choir usually sings in tune. I am so sorry. And then I started home. Now, normally, I don't hear God talking to me.
Yes.
I pray, I read the Bible, but, you know, he usually doesn't just seem to say a whole lot to me directly. Some people he does all the time, and I'm glad for them. I mean, but that day, I really felt he did. I was in trouble. Because it seemed to me he said something like this. You were really embarrassed that a member of the New York Philharmonic heard you play when you hadn't prepared. Yeah. Why weren't you embarrassed that I was hearing you play when you weren't prepared? Who are you doing this for? Them or me? Because I'm there every week. And you never apologize to me when you don't do your best. And I said, God, I'm sorry. You're right. I ought to care more about what you think than what someone else thinks. And I'm not going to walk in again unprepared. Now, all of that is to say this. Know your subject. Do your best. Now, someone has already said, but I don't think I'm very good at what I'm called to do. I'm not saying don't do this unless you're the best one in the world. Okay? I am saying this. Do your best. And then God will come in and make up the difference. But I'm convinced, I can't find a verse to prove this, but I'm convinced that when Jesus preached the Sermon on the Mount, he had prepared that sermon. He knew what he wanted to say. It's organized very well. You say, well, yeah, he was God. Yes, but he was acting in his humanity. and he prepared. Give your very best. When Paul began to minister, he is highly qualified. He isn't just making this stuff up. He works to be prepared. As a teacher, give your students your best. Jesus communicated his goals to his students. One of the reasons I think sometimes Sunday school, and understand when I talk about Sunday school and I say something that sounds negative, it's not because I don't think Sunday school is important. I think it's because sometimes we don't do it very well. How many of you can remember being in Sunday school as a child? Most of you didn't. Okay, all right. I should have thought of that. Understand your students. I'm breaking my rule, aren't I? I went to Sunday school every Sunday growing up. And I cannot remember more than 3 or 4 times that I can actually remember a Sunday school lesson. Okay? One of those I remember because the student next to me wasn't listening. And when the teacher said, ask some question, he just looked up and said, goats. Goats. But one of the reasons is this. Very rarely did a teacher say to us, this is what you're going to learn today. And you know why? It helps our students if we will tell them. This is what the goal is. Jesus gave his goals. He says to Peter, from now on, you will what? Be catching men. Is that a pretty clear goal? When Peter goes back out, remember after resurrection, Peter's discouraged. And what's he do? He goes fishing. Do you think that as he's, I started to throw out the rod, as he's bringing in the net, do you think in the back of his mind he remembers and he says, this isn't what Jesus called me to do. Jesus said, I'm not going to be fishing for fish. I'm going to be fishing for men. And about that time, as he's thinking, this isn't my call. This isn't my ministry. This isn't my goal. Someone comes running up and says, Peter, I have a message from you, for you. From who? From an angel. Yeah. No, really. He said that you're to go meet Jesus in Galilee. And Peter says, nah, that's not for me. That's for the others. No. The message says, go tell his disciples and Peter. Mark 16. And Peter realizes the goal, it's still there. He hasn't given up on me. Let your teachers, students know the goal. Over and over, Jesus says to his disciples, here's the goal. Luke 24, this is what you're going to do. God is going to make you, you're going to witness to Judea, Samaria, the ends of the earth. Then he gives them a final exam in Acts when they go do it. And Acts 2 tells us, Peter preaches and there's 3,000 fish. That's the exam. And he's able to say, yes, I got the goal. Over and over, when Paul teaches, Titus, I don't have time to go through this, but Titus, every chapter of Titus, he will say, I put you in Crete to do this. I sent you to do this. This is what you're supposed to do. I encourage you as teachers, start to say to your students in Sunday school class, the goal for today is this. Before they go home, here's the goal of how you're going to practice this week. Here's how you're going to apply this lesson. And then the next week, what do you ask? How did you do? If none of them did it, what do you need to do? Teach the lesson again because somehow it didn't work. Right? Give them the goals. Now, let me see. I'm going to... I tell you what I want to do. You've got the handout, you can read this, but let me jump to the very end. Because I want to say one more thing about Jesus' teaching, and then I'll let you go. I really want to talk to you about this. Do you mind if I go 5 minutes over? Can I have permission to go 5 minutes over? Okay. One of the things here is good teachers follow their schedule, but I'm going to skip that one. Let me do one thing, because I think this is so important, and that is on communication. On communication. Jesus is a master communicator. Can the blind lead the blind? Won't they both fall in a ditch? If you hear that statement, are you going to always remember that? Yeah. What if he had said it like this? You really can't help people if you have the very same problem they have, because then you're just going to keep doing the same thing they do, and neither of you will get any better. Everybody going to remember that when you go home? No. Can the blind lead the blind? Aren't you going to both go in the ditch? That you'll remember, right? If you're a rich person and you're relying on your riches and you think that's going to get you to heaven, it's not going to work. Okay, you understand. But when he says, you know what? It's easier to squeeze a camel through the eye of a needle than to squeeze a rich man into heaven. You going to remember that one? Yeah. He tells, I've already talked about the parable of the Good Samaritan last time, so I'm not going to go over that. But the Good Samaritan story, they all remembered that story, because the Samaritan is never good. You might as well call it the parable of the good bad person, because a Samaritan is never good. They will always remember that. Almost never, when people come and ask Jesus a question, he almost never gives them an answer. Have you noticed that? Go through and take your Bible and do this. If you use markers, take a yellow marker and highlight all the questions that people ask him. And then take a pink marker and highlight the answers. It never works like this. They come and say, Jesus, what do I have to do to have eternal life? Jesus never says, well, there are four spiritual laws. Have you noticed that? He never does that. He says, well, let me tell you a story. And he tells them a story. And then at the end he says, now, let me ask you a question. And he asks a question. And the question is the answer to their question. But they never forget it after that. They say to his disciples, why is Jesus spending all this time eating with sinners? Now, you ask me and I say, I'll tell you why. But not Jesus. He says, you know, once upon a time, there was a man who had two sons. What's he telling a story for? But at the end of that story, do they have the answer to the question of why is Jesus eating with sinners? Yeah, he's a great communicator. We usually think in terms of questions. When we are teaching a class, we want questions that have an easy answer, that it's easy for us to mark, right or wrong. You know, true or false question, that's easy to grade, right? Jesus never does that. Instead, his definition of a good question is one that opens up a brand new world to his students. I read that it usually takes 3 seconds. When you ask students a question, it takes 3 seconds for them to process the question and prepare an answer. Now, think about that for a moment. I ask a question, 1, 2, 3. How many of you, when you ask a question, consistently wait at least 3 seconds for the answer? They say we should wait 7 seconds to allow everyone to process the question and the answer. But the average teacher waits 0.9 seconds before calling on someone. Because, you see, here's what happens in your class. Your class is the same as mine. 20 students. You ask the question. The average is 3 seconds that it takes them to figure this out. Okay? But remember that the student right back here in the corner is slower than average. It took them 3 seconds to realize you were even talking. Okay? So they need 7 seconds. But on the front row is your great student. This is the smart one. And she can answer in half a second. Before you get the question out, she's already, who knows? You got a student like that? Yeah, I had one last year. So we're talking and I said, who is it that? And I just stopped. What's the rest of the question? I said, I thought you knew. You have your hand up. You tell me. And the students who most need time don't get it. Because once we've called on someone, what do the rest of them do? They quit thinking. We're done, right? I ask a question, and Sister Evelyn, I remembered your name, it's a miracle, raises her hand and I call on her. The rest of you don't need to think about it anymore, right? Do this in your teaching. It'll make a world of difference. Count to 7 after every question. That's long. But it allows everyone to get involved. Because this may amaze you, but some of those slow thinkers in your class have the most ability. They're the smartest. They're thinking through much deeper than this one. This one is good at exercising. You know, they get lots of exercise. But there's another one in there that's kind of slow. A Thomas, who is thinking, now, can I really trust this? They're thinking, but you know what? It's the Thomas who's going to go to India and get martyred. Okay? The one sitting up here doing this is going to be doing this the rest of her life. But Thomas is going to die as a martyr in India. He needs time. Take time. Questions. I just did this real quick. This column is the questions we tend to ask. Yes. The Great Wall was built. Isn't that easy to memorize the answer to? Yeah. The Great Wall was built during which dynasty? True or false? Those are easy, right? But look at these questions. Why did they build the wall? Did it achieve its purpose? Was it worth what it cost? Do you see these questions will stick with you for a while? They're questions you have to think about on this side. If you were an emperor, knowing what it cost in lives, would you do something like the Great Wall? Is it worth it? Ask questions that cause us to think. You see, we're teaching children the story in Luke 2. And we ask them, who was governor of Syria? Cyrenius. Very good. What city did they go to for the birth? Bethlehem. Good. What did the angel say to the shepherds? Fear not, be of good cheer. That's all fine. What about this? Write a poem or just talk about how do you think the shepherds felt when the angels appeared? And someone's going to say, oh, they were happy. They were excited. And someone else is going to say, I think they were afraid. That would be really scary. And then you can say, well, you know, what's the first thing that the angels have to say to them? Don't be afraid. When an angel appears to you, you don't start jumping up and down. You're afraid. Ask students questions that bring them into the Bible. You see, when I think back about Sunday school class, I knew who was governor of Syria before I got there because my dad was a pastor. We had to read this every year before we could open our Christmas gifts. So I knew this story. I wanted to get it over with. But I can't remember a teacher ever asking me to think about what a shepherd felt like when an angel appeared. I can't remember anyone ever saying to me, you know, shepherds were nobodies. Why do you think that's who the angel appeared to first? And you know what? That would have made an amazing difference to me at 7 years old, and here's the reason. I felt like a complete loser. Everyone in school was better at sports than me. Everybody in school was better, faster, stronger, bigger. I was the runt in the class. My sister played the piano better than me. There was nothing I did better than anyone else. And it would have just been amazing to me to find out when I was 7 that when an angel appeared in the Bible, they didn't appear to all my classmates who were better than me. The angel appeared to someone like me. That would have been life-changing to me. And I didn't find that out until I got to college. Help your students to understand what Scripture is about and how it speaks to them. Let me finish with this. I didn't put this on the PowerPoint because I don't want you to misunderstand it. And so I decided I would say it. I wouldn't write it down because if someone reads the PowerPoint, I don't want them to misunderstand. But it's one of the most important things I want to say to you today, and that is this. Jesus, the master teacher, was a wasteful teacher. Now, here's what I mean, and this is why I didn't write it down. I said this in one class, and someone got very upset at me. Jesus never wasted anything. Let me help you to understand. John chapter 6. From that time, many of his disciples went back and walked no more with him. When Jesus is teaching them, does he know that some of them are going to turn back? No. But he teaches them anyway. Someone once preached a sermon titled, Judas, the Disciple Jesus Loved. Because did Jesus love Judas? No. Till the end. Did he know that Judas was going to turn against him?
Yes.
Yes. I say the wasteful teacher because he poured it out knowing that some of the seed would fall on rocky ground and would not grow. He loved them knowing that some of them would take his love and turn their back on him. I've tried to tell you some stories of teachers who love students and it changed their lives. If I'm completely honest with you, I will tell you, I'm sure you all read the story this last month of a man murdering his wife in Hope Sound and cutting up her body and burying. And he was one of our students at our academy. And I know the teachers loved him. I know his mother. She is a wonderful, godly mother who raised him with love. And he'll never leave prison. Sometimes you'll love students and they won't respond. And sometimes you'll feel like this is a waste. Why do I study? Why do I prepare? Why do I pour myself into my class? And they go the wrong way. But I want you to understand that Jesus also poured himself into students, knowing that sometimes they'll turn away. But you do it because you're following the example of Jesus, the master teacher. Some of you may know the story of Nate Saint. He was one of the people who flew into Colombia and was killed by the what they called then the Aka Indians. His son, Steve, became a rebel. He was angry that God had let his father be killed, became very angry. As a young man, he becomes an English teacher. And he goes to Africa to teach English, not as a missionary, not a Christian. Goes as an English teacher. But while he's there, he meets this African Christian. And the Christian, or this African says to him, "You ought to be a Christian." And Steve says, "I'm not interested in being a Christian. Why are you a Christian?" And this African says, "I'll tell you why I'm a Christian. I found a book. And it's the book of a woman whose husband was murdered by Indians in Colombia. And she became a missionary to those Indians after her husband was murdered. And they became Christians." And this African said, "If there was a Jesus who could give that kind of love, I wanted to know him." Steve began to cry and said, "That book's about my mom and dad." He became a Christian. He actually lives here in Florida and runs a mission, powerful mission. And the man who murdered his dad is an elder in the church, and his children call that man Grandpa. I said that Jesus is a wasteful teacher, and I mean this. He loved, he taught, even when there was no response. But the reason I didn't put that on the PowerPoint is I want to make sure you understand it's never wasted. Isaiah says, "My word will not return void." And so, yes, you may teach, you may pour yourself into it, and at times you may go home and say, "What a waste." I read the news this last week, and I said, "What a waste. We poured ourselves into that boy, and it did nothing." But I really believe Isaiah says, "My word will not return void." And what you pour into your students, what you give to them, it will cost you. If it doesn't cost you something, you're really not giving it your best. But what you pour into them may feel wasted. But ultimately, God is going to accomplish his purpose, and he's going to use you to do it. So don't ever give up on them. Love them. Care for them. God can use you to transform their lives. Let's pray. Dear God, I thank you once more for the students that you bring to us. Children that have so much potential. Sometimes we don't see it. Our frustration at some of the things they do, some of the foolish decisions they make, we can become very discouraged. But would you help us to be faithful, to pour ourselves into them, so that like Paul, we can say, "Follow me as I follow Christ." And use the teachers here at the church to transform the lives of their students, to raise up a generation of young Christians who are committed to you, who love you with all their heart. I pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Thank you so much for coming. Yeah, you have to adapt it for every level. Okay, you're not going to ask the same questions for a 6-year-old as a 13. But at every level, you can ask them some questions that go beyond just the true and false. You know, a six-year-old isn't going to understand everything that a teenager understands, but a six-year-old can understand that, you know, if a huge angel appears, you're going to be afraid. So you have to adapt it. But I think at every level there can be questions that help them to really think. And give them time, absolutely, yeah. Give them time. Those kind of questions you can't do in 0.9 seconds. They need time to think. Good. One of the teachers at the school, I had never seen this. She has a cup with little sticks, like from a ice cream bar, for every name of the student. Okay. And by the way, and I'm sure you know this, but always ask the question first and then the name. Because if I say, Brother Paul, who was, everyone else is off the hook. You already know. He has to know. I don't. So ask the question and then the name. And what she does, which I like because it makes sure that everyone gets called. Yeah, she says, who was, she asks the question, and then she pulls out a name. And that way, every question, you have an equal chance of getting called. But always ask the question after the name. Because once you ask the name, once you say the name, everyone else is off the hook. And we're lazy, so am I. You know, if I don't have to come up with the answer, why bother?